I'm Jane Hilton, and this is KBOC at the Heart of the Arts. I'm joined today by Philip Mann, this week's guest conductor with the Phoenix Symphony. Philip is currently the music director of the Arkansas Symphony and is frequently sought out as a guest conductor. He's also a former Rhodes Scholar and a winner of the Vienna Philharmonic's Carillon Fellowship. And I might add, he's also a former ASU Sun Devil. Welcome back to the Valley, Philip.
Thanks so much, Jane. It's delightful to be with you.
Well, I have to ask, what initially drew you to the path of the conductor?
Oh, that's a fantastic question. And it's probably a long answer, but I'll try to make it brief. And it's that I grew up in a musical household. It was full of chamber music and guest artists coming through and practicing on our piano downstairs. And my father was a conductor, and I saw the impact that he could have as a music director on the community at large. And it was one day that I remember that I think kind of told me that that was the path I wanted to take, and it's when he unfortunately succumbed to cancer, and they had to close down Main Street in my hometown because so many people came out to pay their respects. Many people who probably hadn't even met him before, but I thought if a single artist can make that big of a difference in a community, I would be so blessed and lucky to be able to make a difference like that. And that was the day where I thought, well, let's try this out. Let's put the head down and run into what looks like a very competitive brick wall of a career, and I've lived a charmed existence so far.
I didn't realize you had such a wealth you were drawing from.
Well, I was lucky to have parents that really believed in the importance of kind of a daily music experience for a kid, something I think is important for every child, especially public school children, to have a daily arts experience. It allows people to reach the full measure of their potential. It makes our lives more beautiful. And to put it in the other fashion, I think a life without it is impoverished in some ways. So I was fortunate to have that. And that's one of the best things about being a music director is the soapbox that it comes with, where I can act as an advocate for arts education and speak to education policy and things like that. It doesn't sound very artistic, but in fact, it's probably the most important thing for the art form right now.
When I look at your bio, it's very impressive. You've got all these very famous conductors you've studied with, Simon Rattle, also Robert Spano, Pinchas Zukerman. When you look back at all these conductors you've studied with, are there any lessons that serve you every time you step up to the podium?
Well, I tell you the same thing I tell my students, which is just always be a sponge. And I hope that when I'm 80 years old, I'm learning at the same pace and it's the same rate that I was on the first day I decided to become a conductor. And you learn what not to do, you learn what to do, and you see how different people's personalities and styles are able to blossom and come out in front of a group. But looking at all of those different people that I've been so fortunate enough to work with and all these great orchestras to have been assisting conductors at places like the Berlin Philharmonic and Vienna Philharmonic and Concertgebouw in Amsterdam and Cleveland Orchestra, I think what it reinforces for me is true. I mean, it sounds cliche, but everything is about the music. And as a conductor, that means how you rehearse, what you do, how you conduct, how you speak to people, how you plan strategically or artistically an organization, how you even plan the relationship of a community with the repertoire. It all has to be about the music. And if it's not about the music, you're probably going down the wrong path. So all of those different great individuals I was so privileged to work with, I think reinforce that if you ever have a tough decision to make, or if you don't know what the right answer or direction is, just go back to the music and you're going to find an answer that's going to point you in the right direction.
I'm going to quote from your bio now. Beginning his third season as music director of the Arkansas Symphony Orchestra, both previous years shattered attendance records and were accompanied by unprecedented artistic growth, new energy, and financial health. Well, congratulations on that. That's not many orchestras can claim that at this time. What can you say the reason for your success was, or the orchestra's success?
And that's actually a year old. We've had it's my fourth year now, and we've had 3 years of all-time attendance records, and we really are on quite a roll there. And I think the credit belongs to the entire symphony family there. It was the engagement of the board and management with the musicians and a really positive relationship, keeping a great rapport and dialogue between the public and the musicians. Ultimately, what it came down to, though, I think, was re-energizing the orchestra and introducing them back to the public in a way that made them seem not in an ivory tower and not an elitist art form, but something that was for everybody. One of the very first things I did when I got there is we decided to give free tickets to every kid on Sunday concerts, whether it was Pops or Masterworks or a family concert, whatever. We have a very large concert hall, so 2,800 seats, so there wasn't a big loss of revenue there, but what it did do is it made our audiences start to look like the state. Diversity there was not all types of diversity, so whether it was age diversity, which is, of course, a very big thing you hear about in symphony audiences. Everyone yells about the graying audience of symphonies. Of course, you can go back to 19th century newspaper articles and they say the same thing. It's not necessarily really the case, but it's a wonderful thing to look out and see grandparents bringing their grandchildren, kids bringing their parents. And what we've found is having that kind of youthful energy also in the hall, it creates an experience that is much more family-oriented, and it helps us to instill the appreciation and love of the art form earlier. Giving you a sprawling answer, I feel like, because it's, you know, we're trying to comprise, you know, distill 3 years down into a couple minutes here, but I think it was the fact that everybody bought in around an artistic ideal and a vision, and the orchestra has blossomed artistically, and the audience has responded to that, which in turn has made the orchestra want to work that much harder for them. And I count myself privileged just to have been a part of the process.
Now, the role of the music director, it's really changed the last few decades. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, it's especially in the United States, because it hasn't necessarily changed that much outside the states. But it's certainly when you talk about the nonprofit sector following 2008, especially when everyone has really felt the pressures, whether it was on university campuses or healthcare, but certainly in the performing arts, we've all really felt the pressures financially with shrinking endowment income and things like this. And it's changed in terms of the importance of a music director and being that another card that you can play in the community to help make the organization financially sustainable. For me, a music director is always the person who's responsible for the artistic product. I mean, you're there to make sure that the city gets the best possible music. You know, world-class orchestra. Great cities deserve great orchestras. And for me, I think that for a modern music director in the States, that means that the job applies to promoting that artistic product in other ways besides conducting. So whether that means fundraising or doing a lot of media appearances, or maybe it's speaking on behalf of arts advocacy, or maybe it's speaking on behalf of the performing arts sector at the state legislature, or talking about public arts funding, or building connections between universities and for-profit entities. All of those things, in my mind, actually serve the music. It goes back to my mantra, it's all about the music. So While some people, you know, I have colleagues that really want to just focus on score study and standing on stage, and I totally appreciate that, and I absolutely identify with that. What I try to do is I try to not make a distinction whatsoever between those activities outside the concert hall and those inside, because ultimately all of the success with these other activities outside the concert hall make what we do in the hall that much more special, that much more successful, and it raises the bar and potential for everybody.
So this week's concert does include Beethoven's Fourth Piano Concerto. You're working with pianist Andrew von Oyen. Can you give us a little bit of a preview on what we might expect?
Well, for fans of Beethoven, especially the piano concerto, the fourth holds a special place in all of our hearts. Andrew and I both, it's our favorite, and I think that comes out in the performance. It sounds cliche or banal, but it's a magical piece. I mean, it is just extraordinary in its subtleties and of orchestration, the melodic lines and shading of dynamic and harmonic coloring. It just goes right into your heart, this piece. And I think what we're having right now is a wonderful collaboration. Andrew and I have only worked together one other time, coincidentally on the Emperor Concerto. So we've spent a little bit of time in Beethoven together. And the collaboration really has extended beyond just Andrew and I. The Phoenix Symphony is doing a superlative job, a very sensitive job of accompanying him. And I think we're in store for some really nice things this weekend.
Now, the rest of the program, want to give us a little background on that?
Sure. So, the first half of the program, we have not just the Fourth Concerto of Beethoven, but we also have the Egmont Overture. Both of those, by the way, premiered on the same concert with the Fifth Symphony and lots of other things. You imagine how one premiere day changed the course of Western art music. It's incredible. And I thought, well, you know, we've got this big chunk of Beethoven, which really established the modern symphony orchestra in a lot of ways. I mean, when we think of what established the culture and expectation of modern symphony orchestras, you look at the Beethoven symphonies and, you know, earlier in the Haydn Mozart symphonies, of course. But let's look at what came after that. And we have two kind of end of the line paths that are represented on the second half. We have Strauss being the late Romantic Germanic style, and then we have Debussy representing the height of Impressionism. And we have Strauss's Don Juan, great tone poem that gives an opportunity really for the Phoenix Symphony to show off. I mean, the great talent that is represented within the ranks of your orchestra here is going to be truly on display in that piece. They're handling it with aplomb. There's a sense of flair and panache. It's really electric. I'm really enjoying the experience with them. And then you look at, and that's one way, that's one path that Germanic composers took from Beethoven before we entered into, you know, 20th century things. And a divergent path that took us to someplace else was the Impressionist path, still owing a lot back to Beethoven, but taking a different, you know, changing, you know, taking a different direction in music history. And that's, of course, Debussy and Ravel and people like that. And we have Lemaire, which for people that look to the French Impressionists as definers of 20th century style, Lemaire may be one of the most, if not the most important piece of the 20th century. Now we talk about Rite of Spring and things like that, but Lemaire is a perfect piece. It has symmetry, elegance, mathematical symmetry, color, orchestration, a palette that it belies definition, really. I find that when you work with this piece that seems like a painting, that seems like something you appreciate in a non-visceral way, you're looking at a painting of a sea scene and you see a storm and things like that, it doesn't do justice to this great piece, because experiencing this piece is like experiencing the sea firsthand. And for people who have been close to the ocean, you know that it's almost a presence. It's almost a person there. For instance, if you've lived on the coast and then moved away from it, you feel like you almost have lost a family member or something. And Lemaire somehow captures that feeling where the sunrise over the sea is like an opening up or a re-engagement with a friend, and that terrifying, terrible storm scene at the end is truly bone-shaking in its in a way that almost like you're confronted with an entity, a person of that power and terrifying influence on you. So I find that while some people look at Impressionist works as points of sound to be all appreciated maybe from the distance, it's actually a viscerally engaging thing that I think the audience will find, that all of their senses will truly be engaged, especially at the end of that, in that storm scene.
Do you find that I remember being introduced to Debussy's music for the first time, and it took me a while to really sink in and have a love for it. And now I absolutely love his music. Did you have a similar experience, or were you engaged with Impressionism right from the get-go?
I think the key to appreciating Impressionist music is to walk into the experience with your imagination turned on already. What you can't go in is to go in and look for the tune that you want to whistle within the first 30 seconds. What you have to do is go open up and allow something to be presented to you, and then just think about what that means to you. I mean, that incredible opening scene in Lemaire where the sun hasn't come up yet and you just hear this kind of plane of sound, harp texture, where, and then these glances of kind of flashes of light as they skip across the top of what presumably are waves. You know, it's not something that you're going to go home singing to your family, but at the same time, it's absolutely extraordinary. And I find that it's one of these things that if you can introduce it to kids, they come in with no baggage whatsoever. They don't know what they should like or shouldn't like, and they just love that kind of music. And then for adults, I think it's helpful to remind people that when you go in there, to engage with the stage. I mean, to open up and look at what's happening. Let it sink in, and then pass some judgments.
That's a great way to look at it. Thank you for that. I do want to ask about guest conducting. When you are meeting an orchestra for the first time and running that first rehearsal, what is the biggest challenge?
You know, working with an orchestra for the first time is almost like dating somebody, because it's all about chemistry. And I've been very, very fortunate to have great chemistry with a lot of orchestras. And I think it's because if you go into any new relationship with a strong opinion, you know how to have a conversation with somebody. So if you know what you want musically, if you have a very strong opinion about what you want to bring to the table, you have a starting point in the relationship. I think that's the tough thing. The tough thing is actually what you do before that week with the orchestra. The tough thing is all of those hours at a desk in score study deciding what every single note in the score means and what you want to bring and share that with the orchestra. And in doing it with a sense of wonder and curiosity and love for the music has always resulted in a really wonderful experience for me with new orchestras. Working as a guest conductor is a little bit of a charmed existence as well, because it's like, in some ways you're kind of a lover of the orchestra. You're there in a fleeting, ephemeral way. You're there to present something that you love and are passionate about, and then next week maybe you're someplace else. And it's a very different thing than being a music director, but at the same time the responsibilities are the same. It all comes back to bringing something really compelling musically.
I never thought about that. That's a good comparison. Well, you are returning to the Valley. I imagine it's been some time since you've been in Phoenix. Is there anything you are going to revisit, old stomping grounds, old restaurants that you're glad to re-encounter?
Oh, I'm thrilled to be back in the Valley. I've had all these texts and Facebook messages and emails from friends and former colleagues and teachers at Arizona State University. As you know, I was a student here as an undergrad, and I have so many fond memories of this city. In fact, I think it's a city that is full of just tremendous potential and aspirational energy, and it's one of my favorite places. I have lots of restaurants that I can't wait to visit. I want to stomp around the campus a little bit at the university and maybe run into some old friends, and I've already met up downtown with a few of them as well. So it's been a really inspiring week to work with this great orchestra, but also a kind of a homecoming in a way for me.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak with you, Philip, and I want to say I wish you luck, but I think I'm supposed to say break a leg this weekend at the four concerts, one at Scottsdale this evening at 7:30 p.m. at the Scottsdale Center for the Arts, and Friday and Saturday at Symphony Hall in downtown Phoenix.
It's been an absolute pleasure, Jane. Thank you so much.